live and beamed from the New Horizons spacecraft on its way to the outer reaches of the solar system with the goal of proving that the demotion of the planet Pluto was a horrible, horrible mistake. It's the Mike Novak Show, green living, gardening, and the environment of this planet.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
And thanks for tuning in on your 21st century or even 20th century device. This is Mike Novak himself in person. A few weeks ago, I was privileged to be able to speak with entomologist and author Dr. Douglas Tallamy, who, it must be said, is also the creator of a movement which started with the publication of his book, Bringing Nature Home, How Native Plants Sustain Wildlife in Our Gardens. That led to an updated version of the book and a new title, The Living Landscape, co-authored with Rick Dark. Meanwhile, he's been speaking all over the country, including for the West Cook Wild Ones. You might remember I recently did a show about their wildlife corridor, and they had something called the Living Landscape Conference at Dominican University in River Forest, where 300 people listened to Tallamy explain why our entire existence is at risk if we continue to allow our insects, birds, and native plants to disappear. I recorded that presentation, but also spoke with him one-on-one, and this entire program is a kind of mashup of both. Doug Tallamy has a lot to teach us about how to be stewards of this planet, and that's coming up next.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app. The sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
Thinking about going organic? If you want to have a beautiful landscape and be kind to the environment, you need to try Milorganite Organic Nitrogen Fertilizer. For more than 85 years, Milorganite has been practicing sustainability using natural organic material that is not based on the petroleum industry. Its slow-release, goof-proof formula provides consistent feeding, and it's safe for your children and pets. In fact, Milorganite is the nation's oldest recycler, focusing on reduction of consumption, waste, and emissions. And it works. Visit Milorganite.com to find a garden center near you.
Looking for a housing investment that can pay big dividends? Remodel your kitchen or bathroom. You'll freshen up your home and add value to it, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling needs. Kitchens, bathrooms, master suites, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Don't it always seem to go? But you don't know what you got till it's gone. It'd be a paradise, put up a fucking line.
Very pleased after all these years to have Doug Tallamy on the show, professor and chair of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware, author of at least three books.
Two books.
What about Bringing Nature Home?
The Living Landscape.
And, oh, that's true. I'm thinking of the updated version of Bringing Nature Home because you changed it. And that's actually kind of interesting because it started as Bringing Nature Home, How Native Plants Sustain Wildlife in Our Gardens. That was the book that came out in 2007.
Right.
And the one that got my attention and got a lot of other people's attention, and I'll get to that in a second. Then you updated and expanded the book, Bringing Nature Home, but you changed the subtitle, How You can sustain wildlife with native plants. And it seems to me that's your progression, because your second book was The Living Landscape, Designing for Beauty and Biodiversity in the Home Garden. So you moved from making an observation to, uh-oh, how do I get people engaged? Is that what happened?
Absolutely, because I think it's 82% of the land in the U.S. is privately owned, which means each landowner has an enormous responsibility in maintaining the life that exists in this country. So, yes, we have to get everybody who has control of a piece of property involved. And even if you don't own a piece of property, you know somebody who does. You know a public park. We need to recognize that the plants in these spaces are going to make or break life in the future.
That simple, huh?
It boils. Yeah.
Well, and it seems to me that is how you approach it, because when you go to your website, when you read your book, you have this horrific litany of what we've done to the country. In fact, at one point you say, "Well, we've altered 95% of our landscape here in America," and that's in America. I guess you could probably extrapolate that for the planet worldwide to some degree, right?
That is true. That statistic is focused on the lower 48 states. But of course, if you factor in climate change, you're easily up to 100%, because there's no area in this continent that's not going to be affected by climate change. But in terms of the integrity of the habitat, yes, 95%. Only 5% can be considered relatively pristine, and that's because we've logged it. At some point, very few original forests left.
Old growth.
You. Senior moment. Yeah. Very few, and those are in. The
I know. West. I had a house out in the Pacific Northwest in the National Forest for a while, a vacation home, in the old growth, that was a revelation to me. And this was, you know, starting 25 years ago, and it made me realize that, and I've said this many times, if I become president first thing tomorrow, all the old growth logging stops. Yeah. It just stops.
Yeah.
And I don't think we understand how important it is to have old growth.
You know, people look at a 100-year-old oak and they say, wow, what an old, wonderful tree. Oaks live 900 years. It's just that we don't see that anymore. They have root systems that go out 300 yards from the base of the tree. That doesn't happen anymore, because you can't go, 25 yards before you hit a sewer line or a street or a foundation. And that's why our trees don't live as long as they used to. But in the old majestic forest, we had huge trees that provided all kinds of habitat for all kinds of creatures.
What's the specialized relationship with hummingbirds? Your turn to talk. Oh, you know too much. I want you to say nectar so that I can say, no, you're wrong. The specialized relationship with chickadees is just like the other birds. 80 to 90% of their diet is insects and spiders. Yes, they eat nectar after that. So you can put up your nectar feeder, but if you don't have insects and spiders, you're not going to have the hummingbirds around to do that. And that is true with 96% of our terrestrial birds in North America. They rear their young on insects, or the book will say other arthropods, which typically are spiders. But of course, spiders needed insects to become spiders. 96% of our birds. This is news to a lot of people. It's news to the people who write landscape for birds books, because all they talk about is how to put plants in your yard that make seeds and berries. And we do need seeds, and we do need berries, as long as they're the right berries. And many birds depend on that certain times of the year. But when they're making more birds, which is a really important time in a bird's life history, they need the plants that are going to make the insects that will support their reproduction. Otherwise, you won't have the birds at all. So, no insects, no baby birds. All right, what types of landscapes are capable of doing that? What types of landscapes are capable of making the abundance and diversity of insects that are required to support these food webs? Well, to answer that question, we have to consider the most common type of specialized relationship that we have all over the planet, and that's the relationship between the insects that eat plants and the plants themselves. I'm not talking about pollinators here. I'm talking about the insects that are actually chewing on those leaves. Remember, plants really don't want to be eaten. They want to capture the energy from the sun and use it for their own growth and reproduction, so they have loaded their tissues. fruit leaves with nasty tasting chemicals, secondary metabolic compounds that make those tissues either bitter or downright toxic. And it's an extremely effective defense that keeps most of the insects of the world from eating most of the plants of the world. And that's why we can look outside in the summertime and it's green. It's green not because there's nothing out there that wants to eat those leaves. It's green because most of those leaves are chemically protected. They are unavailable to the things that want to eat them. But we do know that insects eat plants, so how do they do that? How do they get around those chemicals? Well, they specialize. 90% of the insects that eat plants are what we call host plant specialists, where they are eating one or maybe two lineages of plants that share a common cocktail of chemical defenses. And the reason they specialize is they have to develop the adaptations that allow them to circumvent those chemical defenses. They have to develop the enzymes, the physiological mechanisms that allow them to eat these toxins without dying, the behavioral adaptations and the life history adaptations that help them avoid these compounds altogether. But in order to develop all those relations, those specializations, they need to have a long period of exposure to those plant lineages. These things do not happen overnight.
We've also imported, we now have 3,300 species of invasive plants in this country, so almost a third of the vegetation in the U.S. is from Asia.
Let me ask a question about that, and we're this is the conversation, as usually happens when I'm the guy doing the interview, is going off in directions I hadn't counted on, but in terms of invasive vegetation, and just say exotic. Let's not even say invasive. Let's say exotic, as in not from North America, okay? Or if you're in Europe, not from Europe. You know, it comes from North American plants wreak havoc in other parts of the world.
That is right.
When do we get to the point when we say it's a world biology and we just have to accept it?
We call that biotic homogenization, where plants are moving around the world and all the ecosystems start to look the same. When do I accept that? Never. This is not an inevitable. It's not an inevitable event, and I can tell you that because our 10 acres at home is not invaded anymore. We're controlling it. Is it labor free? No, but it's a whole lot more productive than when it was a mass of multiflora rose and oriental bittersweet and autumn olive. We brought these plants in. We're still bringing them in on purpose. We're selling most of them in our nurseries. None of that is necessary. Doesn't mean we're going to close down nurseries. We just have to change the inventory. We have to recognize that the plants that we're putting in our landscapes have ecological function. They have ecological roles. And if we only plant plants for their beauty, we lose those roles. So we're not going to throw out beauty. We're going to have beautiful plants that are also functional.
All right, you're a positive guy. This is honest to goodness. This is what I get from your writing, because you're a positive guy in a situation in a world and where things are out of control. 95% of our landscape has been altered, and as you say, that means that 95% of our wildlife has been altered or is in danger, one way or the other. And now you're talking about us bringing in exotics, which the landscape industry has done forever. And I have been to those meetings, those conferences, where, okay, calorie pear. Let's talk calorie pear, which we're beginning to understand is incredibly invasive. That is Bradford pear and other cultivars. You can't get the industry to stop bringing those in. It's really hard because they say, well, you know, we've got inventory and we're going to lose money. And can we make it 5 years? Can we wait five? And I'm sitting there thinking, no, you can't wait 5 years. What are you talking about? Because 5 years will become 10, 10 will become 15, and then we will have even more of those things around. So how do you fight that?
We could stop it tomorrow, Mike. All we have to do is stop buying those plants. Nobody's going to carry inventory that doesn't sell.
Yeah.
So we have the power to stop selling invasive plants by stopping the purchase of those plants.
But you have to educate the public.
That's what we're doing.
Well,
here.
I know it. And what I was going to start with in this conversation is you're a rock star. Your book is a rock star, and you must know it because you're being asked to speak all over Kingdom Come about this issue. It's which
the,
is a
it's
movement.
The issue. The issue is the rock star. People are interested that here's an environmental problem that they can actually help solve. You can take a role in this. You can see the results. You get positive feedback. It's a good feeling, and it makes a difference. And there are very few other environmental issues where a single person can make a difference. So that is what's attracting people.
Why do we want all these insects? Well, we talked about birds needing them, but it's not just the birds that are relying on insects for protein. We also talk about spiders eating insects. They do. All the spiders eat insects, or they eat other spiders that ate insects. And you may not like spiders, but look who does. It's the second most important component of bird food webs. So simply for the bird's sake, we can't afford to lose our spiders. We would also lose all the insect predators that are eating the insect herbivores. And they themselves are an important part of food webs, which means we would lose our frogs, we'd lose our toads, we'd lose our amphibians because they all eat insects. Our lizards eat insects, our bats eat insects, our rodents eat insects. Why? Because they're really good food. Pound for pound, there's twice as much protein in insect meat as there is in beef. And insects have organs in their abdomen called fat bodies. They're loaded with lipids. These are high-energy compounds that allow these little guys to grow quickly and reproduce quickly. And if you're a mouse, that's what you want to do because there's a lot of things that want to eat you. But it's the same reason that larger organisms are eating insects. The skunk is digging up your yard to get the grubs in your yard. Possums eat a lot of insects. Raccoons eat a lot of insects. And even things we don't think of as insectivores eat a lot of insects. The red fox, 25% of the red fox's diet is insects. 23% of the black bear's diet is insects. So it doesn't matter how big you are, you need insects. And even things that don't eat insects require insects. This is the sharkshin hawk. It's a bird predator. So you might think, well, we can get rid of all the insects in our neighborhood. We can still have sharkshin hawks. But think about it. The birds this guy's eating needed insects to become birds. So it's not eating insects directly, but it's eating them indirectly. Same thing with the garter snake. It eats the frogs and the toads that ate the insects. You can't take insects out of these food webs without the food webs collapsing. As a matter of fact, a world without insects is a world without biological diversity. And E.O. Wilson told us decades ago that a world without biological diversity is a world without humans. That's why this is important. That's why you have to talk beyond the choir. Everybody needs biological diversity. What's happening to that diversity? What's happening to those insectivores? Well, you know, in most of the groups, we're not measuring it at all. But we do measure birds because we like birds. And September of 2014, we had the State of the Birds report come out. 230 species of North American birds now considered at risk of extinction. It's not just the California condor or the whooping crane. 230 species. We have 50% fewer songbirds today than just 40 years ago. So there's something wrong with the ecosystem supporting our birds. That part is clear enough. Again, we need to pay attention to this because those are the same ecosystems that support humans. So if we want to continue on, and most of us would vote for that, we're going to have to figure out what's going wrong.
Hi, I'm Peggy, and I have great news. Natural Awakenings, Chicagoland's only monthly magazine dedicated to healthy and green living, is now available throughout Cook and Lake Counties. We feature articles about fitness, local food and drink, gardening and environment, green energy, healthy kids and families, even healthy pets. Natural Awakenings is free and available throughout the city and suburbs or online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
What do mealy bugs, spider mites, fungus gnats, springtails, scale, aphids, and white flies have in common? If you guessed that they've all been visitors in my house at one time or another, you'd probably be right. But if you said that they were all featured in the latest issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, you'd also be correct. Those little guys often show up on houseplants, and there's a story in this issue about how to make sure that if they bug you, so to speak, they don't do it for very long. Then there's my column on the inside back page. Once you've read it, there are no remedies. Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, a publication of State by State Gardening Magazines. Go to chicagolandgardening.com. But if you're in other parts of the Midwest or the South, try one of the 21 magazines in those regions by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600, 888-265-3600. Now let's get back to my conversation and a lecture by Doug Tallamy.
He took all the trees and put them in a tree museum, and he charged the people a dollar and a half to see them.
Or how do you know when you've succeeded? Again, and there's a zillion ways you can know this, but one thing I get asked all the time is, where are the fireflies gone? Where are the lightning bugs? I used to have a lot when I was young, and I don't see them now. Well, these are not bugs or flies. They are beetles, and as larvae, they are predators in leaf litter. If you clean up and get rid of your leaf litter, you've thrown out the food and the habitat of firefly larvae. If you have Kenbon, you have poisoned them. If you have your garage light on all night long, you've removed them with light pollution. So if fireflies come back to your house or your neighborhood, you are doing something right. If you have holes in your leaves, you are doing something right. This is not a sign to grab the spray can. This is a shingle oak leaf that has passed on part of its energy. Something else is alive because they ate that plant. This is a sign of success. And of course, if you have breeding birds in your yard.
Your book hit a nerve somewhere in a way that I haven't seen. I was writing a piece on this the other day, and I was looking at the seminal books of nature, about nature. And I was thinking, I don't know, a Sand County Almanac, Silent Spring, pretty much anything Michael Pollan writes. And I thought of your book. It's in the same, now you know, you might not say, well, I'm not the same as Rachel Carson, but the effect it's having, the impact it's having on people, I think is similar.
I think it's timing. You know, Rachel noticed a problem at exactly the time that people were willing to listen, and actually, you know, she had an uphill battle.
Yeah.
But she fought it anyway. I think people are ready for this. They've looked around. So many people say, well, where are those lightning bugs I grew up with? How come I don't hear the birds anymore? I don't see any more butterflies. They want to change that. So I happen to see the same thing and write about it at a time where people were willing to listen. Noah's Garden came out, 10, 15 years before Bringing Nature Home. It just was a little bit ahead of its time, but it was pretty much the same message. So that's just luck.
Where does climate change play into this? Because when you wrote your book, you mentioned climate change earlier, and it didn't seem like it was a key part of what you were talking about.
Climate change is not a key part about what I'm talking about. It doesn't mean climate change is not important. It's enormously important. We've got to deal with it. But we could solve climate change tomorrow, and everything that I write about is still an issue. If you pave over the world, it doesn't matter whether you have climate change or not. You've still forced extinction. You've reduced the integrity of our ecosystems to the point where they won't be able to support us anymore. So yes, climate change is an issue, but local extinction, ecosystem degradation, those are serious issues that we need to focus on as well. And you know, those issues are not getting nearly the press that climate change is. People think that nature is out there someplace else and it's happy and healthy and we have all we need. None of those are true.
All right, so talk about why a city park isn't good enough. I mean, people say, well, there's an open space, it's right. Got grass, it's got
exactly.
Trees.
Yeah. A city park is not good enough. It's a good start, but it's got to be part of a connected matrix. Where you have habitat that is not isolated and fragmented. A fragmented piece of habitat can only support a tiny population of various plants and animals. And tiny populations are really vulnerable to local extinction because they all fluctuate. And if you're tiny and you're down cycle, you tend to disappear. And if you disappear from that tiny park, how do you recolonize it? Most species are not nearly as mobile as we think. So just think of the common eastern box turtle. It's eliminated from that park. How are they going to recolonize it? How are the salamanders going to recolonize it? Even many of the birds that you know are so mobile will not recolonize that park because it is not big enough to support breeding populations. So that's the problem. We've got to build functional biological units in between that park and the next park and the preserve down the road, so that life can be supported even in our neighborhood.
Why do we want all these insects? Well, we talked about birds needing them, but it's not just the birds that are relying on insects for protein. We also talk about spiders eating insects. They do. All the spiders eat insects, or they eat other spiders that ate insects. And you may not like spiders, but look who does. It's the second most important component of bird food webs. So simply for the bird's sake, we can't afford to lose our spiders. We would also lose all the insect predators that are eating the insect herbivores. And they themselves are an important part of food webs. which means we would lose our frogs, we'd lose our toads, we'd lose our amphibians because they all eat insects. Our lizards eat insects, our bats eat insects, our rodents eat insects. Why? Because they're really good food. Pound for pound, there's twice as much protein in insect meat as there is in beef. And insects have organs in their abdomen called fat bodies. They're loaded with lipids. These are high-energy compounds that allow these little guys to grow quickly and reproduce quickly. And if you're a mouse, that's what you want to do because there's a lot of things that want to eat you. But it's the same reason that larger organisms are eating insects. The skunk is digging up your yard to get the grubs in your yard. Possums eat a lot of insects. Raccoons eat a lot of insects. And even things we don't think of as insectivores eat a lot of insects. The red fox, 25% of the red fox's diet is insects. 23% of the black bear's diet is insects. So it doesn't matter how big you are, you need insects. And even things that don't eat insects require insects. This is the sharp-shinned hawk. It's a bird predator. So you might think, well, we can get rid of all the insects in our neighborhood. We can still have sharp-shinned hawks. But think about it. The birds this guy's eating needed insects to become birds. So it's not eating insects directly, but it's eating them indirectly. Same thing with the garter snake. It eats the frogs and the toads that ate the insects. You can't take insects out of these food webs without the food webs collapsing. As a matter of fact, a world without insects is a world without biological diversity. And E.O. Wilson told us decades ago that a world without biological diversity is a world without humans. That's why this is important. That's why you have to talk beyond the choir. Everybody needs biological diversity. What's happening to that diversity? What's happening to those insectivores? Well, you know, in most of the groups, we're not measuring it at all. But we do measure birds because we like birds. And September of 2014, we had the State of the Birds report come out. 230 species of North American birds now considered at risk of extinction. It's not just the California condor or the whooping crane. 230 species. We have 50% fewer songbirds today than just 40 years ago. So there's something wrong with the ecosystem supporting our birds. That part is clear enough. Again, we need to pay attention to this because those are the same ecosystems that support humans. So if we want to continue on, and most of us would vote for that, we're going to have to figure out what's going wrong here.
I went out a couple of weeks ago, and talked to the folks here at the Westwood Wild Ones. Wes Cook, there we go. Woo! And I went and visited Pam's backyard and went to across the street from a church and these little plots of land, and there's some natives there, and they're tiny plots, and they're trying to put together what they call a biological or wildlife corridor, and it's a 20 by 20 plot in somebody's backyard, and they're thinking maybe they can get two people to commit per block in a 4-mile area that stretches from a city park, we just mentioned a city park, to a forest preserve. Is this going to work?
It's a start. And what we're doing is changing the culture so that it's not just two people in a neighborhood, so that everybody in the neighborhood, where that's the default landscaping mode, everybody in the neighborhood will have a functional landscape because we're going to recognize that the others are not an option. And it doesn't mean it has to be wild and messy. It doesn't mean you can't have lawn. You just can't have 92% lawn. Cut that in half. Put the oak trees in your yard. Get those functional plants back there. Then you can have breeding birds. You can have scarlet tanagers right in your front yard, believe it or not. And we know this because we've seen it happen in places where groups have done this. So then that creates that connectivity. Is the one or two properties here and there going to make the difference if we stop there? No. But you have to start someplace.
I've read articles about wildlife corridors, and one of the arguments, because it's still an inexact science and we're still discovering how they work, if they work, the question is, do you need to have a contiguous mass? Can you do it in patches? And we don't know the answers to those questions, but you tend to think that that will work.
It depends on the species you're talking about. So if you're talking about a migrating butterfly like the monarch, being able to stop and find good forage as you're moving south along the way after you've flown 2 miles might be good enough. In the long run, though, you want as much connectivity as possible.
We might want to ask the question, how many species do we need? We, as humans, let's be selfish about it. And don't think of extinction as being important only when it's global extinction. Think about your yard. Think about the species that used to be in your yard. Think about the species that are in your yard now. If you have fewer species in your yard now than used to be there, there's a loss of species from your local ecosystem. And that's important because ecosystems function locally, not globally. I don't care if those species are still in the Smoky Mountains. They're not in your local ecosystem. What's the impact on that ecosystem? Well, ecologists have been trying to answer that question since the mid-50s, 1950s that is. Robert MacArthur offered this hypothesis in 1955. He said, as you increase the number of species in an ecosystem, ecosystem function goes up. And you can measure function any way you want. Of course, that also means as you decrease the number of species, then function goes down. Very difficult hypothesis to test. You have to control ecosystems, count all the species, manipulate them. So he didn't test it. He just called it the law of nature. That was that. We've had other hypotheses, the redundancy hypothesis, the rivet hypothesis. They weren't tested either. But in 2012, three studies came out from teams that had created simplified ecosystems, manipulated them for 10 years, and fortunately, they all agree with each other that it looks like MacArthur was right. It's a pretty simple relationship. The more species you have, the more productive your ecosystem is. So, how many species do we humans need? I'm going to argue that we need all of them, because we need as much ecosystem productivity as we can absolutely get. And that's because it's the species in our ecosystems that are creating those ecosystem services that support us. We should call them biodiversity services. And then people would appreciate biodiversity a little bit more. And of course, we've already measured through the Millennial Ecosystem Assessment that we've degraded the planet's ability to produce ecosystem services for humans by 60%. Every time we add something to the planet, we need more ecosystem services, not fewer. But right now, we've got this notion that humans are here, nature's someplace else. So every time we add somebody to this side of the equation, we're taking more nature away to support those people. And of course, that's a recipe for disaster.
We can focus on particular groups, and I like to talk about migrating birds. A lot of our birds will breed up in Michigan or upper Michigan, up into Canada. They're flying north from the Yucatan Peninsula on their way home, and they have to move. They move in a front right across the U.S. As they're migrating, they have to stop and eat, and they stop and eat where they come down after a night's flying. That is right in the middle of our cities. It's right in the middle of our farmland. It is right in your yard, and so that is a little pinpoint habitat need. The migrating bird stops. If you've got a great big oak tree there, it gets enough to eat and it can move on the next day. If you have a ginkgo, it has nothing to eat.
You see, now you're busting me because I've got a ginkgo in my yard.
I am busting you, Mike. That's right. And, Do you have an oak too?
I have a serviceberry.
That'll help, but it's...
But I need an oak. Well, my yard is so tiny.
Yeah.
It's a city lot.
So there's a good example. You have wasted a lot of space with that ginkgo.
I know.
You're killing me here.
Yeah. I looked at it, and for the last couple of years, I've been talking to Kathleen, and I say, I got to cut that thing down.
Well, look at it this way. At least you cannot plant another one. My mother-in-law is in a retirement community. They must have just planted 50 ginkgos. That's where we've got to stop it. If you have a big established ginkgo, cutting it down, no, you don't have to do that. But let's just...
It's not a big established. It's at the point where I could still, at this point, take it down. It's probably 20 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
It's not huge. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about it. The problem is I'm not going to put another tree there. I probably would just leave it open. So I don't know if it's better to leave it or,
Well, all right, that's a good point. If you're trying to help food webs, having nothing there isn't going to do that either.
But I have other things at the base of it. I mean, I've got...
Well, you still have those, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But see, your ginkgo is doing other things. We'll be fair here. The ginkgo is sequestering carbon. It is photosynthesizing. It's creating oxygen. Its root systems are helping the local watershed. The only thing it's not doing well is passing on the energy it gets from the sun. So it's locked up in its tissues. Nothing can eat it. And so those birds, will fly.
And let's explain that for a second. We're talking to Dr. Doug Tallamy, who is the author of The Living Landscape, Designing for Beauty and Biodiversity in the Home Garden, but he's also author of the iconic book, Bringing Nature Home, How Native Plants Sustain Wildlife in Our Gardens. What, folks listening to this might say, wait a second. Everybody tells me that ginkgo is a great urban tree. This is a tree that's going to do really well in the city. Why shouldn't I have a ginkgo?
What they mean is it will live in the city without dying.
the bar is very low there.
Yeah, if existing makes it a great urban tree, they're correct. And I've heard urban foresters say that. We're going to rebuild urban forests with ginkgo. And the reason we're putting,
reading your book.
No, absolutely anymore. First of all, they haven't read the book. And second of all, they say this is a really old tree. And because it has already withstood lots of huge changes on this planet, it's probably going to do fine in climate change as well. That's their argument. And it will accomplish some of the goals of an urban forest. But I don't want to call it an urban forest because forests support other life forms and ginkgo won't.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app. The sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
Let's get back to my conversation with Doug Tallamy at the West Cook Wild Ones Living Landscape Conference.
Hey, farmer, put away your DDT. I don't care about spots on my apples. Leave me the birds and the bees, please.
You've talked about the idea of our insect biomass. Insects are low on the totem pole in terms of understanding, I guess, from our human species. We figure out when we're losing birds and mammals and the megafauna like lions and tigers and black rhinoceroses and white rhinoceroses, but insects not so much.
Sure. So let's talk about the charismatic megafauna, which for so many people today is birds. They're not very big, but they're very charismatic. We got a lot of bird lovers out there. Well, then you just have to think about what are those birds eating, particularly when they're reproducing. What are they feeding their young? And 96% of them are feeding their young insects. And most of those insects are caterpillars. Where do the caterpillars come from? Not from your ginkgo. So that is the problem.
Why don't they come from the ginkgo?
Ginkgo is a tree from Asia, and all plants protect themselves primarily from insects with secondary metabolic compounds, chemicals they put in their leaves that make the leaves either bitter or downright toxic. So plants in Asia do that. Plants in North America do that. The plants in North America have been exposed to North American insects for eons. They've interacted with each other. And our insects have developed the specializations required to get around those chemical defenses. And that's why the monarch only eats Asclepias. They only eat milkweeds. They have the enzymes and the physiological mechanisms to be able to eat cardiac glycosides without dying. They have the behavioral adaptations that allow them to block the flow of the sticky latex sap. But for all those adaptations to fall into place took, eons and eons of interactions with that particular plant lineage. So we call them a host plant specialist. And 90% of our insects that eat plants are host plant specialists. They specialize in the plants they have been associated with for tens and hundreds of thousands of years. Our insects are just meeting ginkgo for the first time. So they don't have the adaptations required to do that.
And it's almost a shame because the ginkgo story is so fascinating. The idea that this is a tree that was here tens of thousands of years ago. And
40 million years.
40 million years. Okay. Thank you for correcting me. Yeah. 40 million years ago, and we thought it had disappeared, and then it shows up. But in the meantime, the world had passed it by to some degree, right?
Well, it had disappeared from North America. And it was retained in Asia. So there are people that say, well, it was here before. That makes it a native plant. My definition of a native plant is a plant from within a local food web that has evolutionary experience within that local food web. So ginkgo was here 40 million years ago, but that local food web was not. So none of the things that are interacting with local plants today were around 40 million years ago. So ginkgo comes back after a 40 million year hiatus, and of course our insects have never seen it before. They don't have the adaptations required to eat it. And some plants are really well protected everywhere. So for example, our ferns, we've got a lot of native ferns, but they're very well protected and very few of our insects can eat them. So they're native, but it doesn't make them very high in the productivity list.
So that's why you go for things like oaks.
Exactly.
Because it supports over 500 different kinds of life forms.
Oh, just caterpillars.
Of just caterpillars?
Just caterpillars. 557 species of caterpillars that we know of. So if you start counting the other things it supports, that list gets much bigger.
There you go. Everybody, plant oak tomorrow. Go out.
Yes, but you first of all, you have to be appropriate to the biome you're in. Now, up here in Michigan, we're transitioning into an oak savanna. So, yes, you have oaks, but you start.
Well, actually, we're in Illinois at the moment.
Oh, that's right. We're going to Michigan tomorrow, right?
That's right.
So, our Illinois, you're still transitioning into prairie ecosystems, but
you were
in oak savanna situations. And as you move further west, it gets too dry for oaks. So don't try to force them into those situations. As you move further east, you can get really oak-dominated forests. But we used to have oak and chestnut. The chestnut's now gone. And beech and hickory and all these other things.
But there you go. The chestnut's gone because of us bringing in
exotic
species, which wiped out. Who wouldn't love to have a chestnut, but we can't grow them anymore.
So I'm going to suggest that we raise the bar on what we're asking our landscapes to do. In the past, we have asked them to be pretty. And we're good at that. Most of them are pretty, but they also need to support life. If we don't support life at home, we're not going to have life anymore, and then that will not be good for us. We need to ask them to support or sequester carbon. A third of the carbon that's in the air right now has come from the trees we've chopped down. So if we put those trees back, we can pull carbon out of the air. We can manage our watersheds. We can support pollinators. You know, we're losing our pollinators. That clean farming technique in the Midwest there gets rid of milkweed, but it gets rid of the other flowering plants as well. We have 4,000 species of native bees. Where do you think they're going to get their forage from? And if I asked anybody why we need pollinators, they would say, because they pollinate our crops. I hear that on NPR all the time. And it's true. A third of our crops are pollinated by animals, typically by bees. But that is not telling the whole story. 80% of all of our plants are pollinated by animals, not just our crops. And 90% of all of our flowering plants are pollinated by animals. If we lose these pollinators, we're going to lose 80-90% of the plants on this planet, and that will be a disaster for humans. We won't be able to stick around from that. So losing our pollinators is not an option. This should be something everybody talks about every minute of every day. So we're really not talking about good land stewardship practices. We're talking about essential land stewardship processes. And we're not there yet in convincing people that these things are essential. People think, if I have time.
But getting back to monarch, which I would argue is also a charismatic megafauna.
Yes.
It's easy when you talk about monarchs and you say, plant milkweed. Don't you wish your message could be that simple for all of the other fauna that you're talking about?
It almost is that simple because the things that the other fauna are eating also are houseplant specialists for the most part. You plant the plants that support the caterpillars that the birds need, and every bird is focusing on different groups of caterpillars. Monarch is one species. It's a great poster child for this because people can learn a lot of things. They can learn about host plant specialization. They can recognize the monarch is not going to adapt to corn or soybeans before it disappears. So people say, well, things will adapt. No, we're changing the world way too fast for the things to adapt to catch up with those changes. So we get to look at how quickly we can take a butterfly that was abundant, hundreds of millions of monarchs, and in just a few years reduce them down to only 3% of their 1976 population.
It's kind of stunning, though, isn't it? And isn't it a cautionary tale about what can happen to all the other insects?
Absolutely. We can measure monarch decline. Are we measuring the decline in the native bees that also need all of the flowering plants?
We don't even know what the native bees are. I mean, we talk to folks and they say, well, we can measure honeybees because they're in hives, but the natives, we go, eh, we really don't really have numbers on that.
Right.
That's just crazy not to know that.
And it's funny. Well, we know we have in the neighborhood of 4,000 species of native bees. We worry about one, honeybee, which
is
not
a native.
but who was doing all the pollination before we brought the honeybee over? It was our native bees. And if I ask somebody, why do we need pollinators? The answer will be because they pollinate our crops. And they do. 30% of our crops are pollinated by animals. But, you know, in China, you know who's doing the pollination now? People. By hand.
They go with brushes, aren't they?
So you can say, well, you know, we really don't need those pollinators. But think about it. They do pollinate our crops, but they pollinate 80% of all plants and 90% of all flowering plants. So even if we hand pollinate our crops, we would lose 80 to 90% of the plants on this planet. And how happy do you think humans would be if that happened? I mean, we'd be gone in a month.
Yeah.
So losing pollinators is not an option. It's not low on the list there.
and yet, I'm not sure that the message is getting across.
It's not. Certainly not. You look at the people, the top 10 things, we're coming up on an election in a year or so, top 10 things people worry about, is losing pollinators on that list?
You would be laughed off the stage. If you said our insect biomass is in jeopardy, you would be considered a crackpot. And yet, if that happens, as you said, we're gone.
Right.
We're history.
Right.
That's part of our problem. And I will give you a perfect example of this. It's not a politician, but my neighbor, who... The other week, my partner and I are going to be planting some stuff in our neighbor's yard because, for various reasons, the yard's available. There's lots of sun, and we're going to put some vegetables. Well, we were, except that she decided to mow the lawn, and she was so proud. She said, "I fertilized." And I said, "Oh no, did you use Weed and Feed?" Well, my lawn at home is really, it's beautiful. I said, "Did you use Weed and Feed?" And she shows me the Weed and Feed bag. Mm-hmm. So she's putting 2,4-D on this. No regard for anything except the turf grass. That's the kind of mentality. She doesn't even know she's using poison.
Right.
All right, she doesn't even realize that. How do we break through and get people to understand that we're losing insect biomass? It seems like it's a huge distance to cover.
We've got a lot of lawn, 45.6 million acres. 8 New Jerseys of lawn. We're adding 500 square miles of lawn to the U.S. every year. Why are we doing that? Because lawn is our status symbol. It's our landscape status symbol. In the old days, only rich people could have lawns. Then we invented the lawnmower, and all of us poor slobs could have lawns. But in the 50s, we were told if it's not a perfect lawn, you're a communist. true enough. And today, turn on the television. You will get an ad telling you, directly or implying, if you have a dandelion in your lawn, you're just not a good person. You're certainly not a good land steward, and you better fix it. But we can change our status symbols. I went to Wyoming last year about this time, and I looked around, and they did not have big lawns. And I asked my host, "Where's your big lawns?" And he said, "Well, you know, we only get 9 inches of rain a year." He said, but lawn is not our status symbol. I said, "Really, why not? What is your status symbol?" And he thought about it and said, "Big belt buckles." I think that's the answer. If we double the size of our belt buckles and cut the size of our lawn in half, we've got it.
I mean, because I'm here, and the people here at this conference today where you're speaking, we've all drunk the Kool-Aid. There aren't nearly enough of us, is what I'm saying.
True, Mike, but your numbers are growing every day. They really are. You know, you can talk to your neighbor. You can explain to her what she just did. Tell her to read the label. When she recognizes that the label says, "Take your shoes off after applying this product," and then you see how long you're supposed to do that, you're supposed to do that the rest of the season. She might say, "Maybe I don't want that on my yard, because I'd actually want to be able to walk around it. Maybe I don't want my son rolling around in it, or my cat." This is what we're doing. And that's why Toronto has banned this stuff.
I know. I love the forward-thinking Canadians.
They say, do we really need this? And why are we doing it? So that we have a green, weed-free lawn.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is the point. When I talk to people, I'm getting militant in my old age here.
Yeah.
I say to them, you know what? You don't need that. You know what? You've been brainwashed. You don't need any of that. I don't know what the heck you're doing, and you need to stop it right now. You know, and people tell you, no. You're supposed to give them candy, not vinegar.
But
that's my style. And I guess the idea, like you're preaching the gospel of this. Let's go out. Let's recruit people. Let's proselytize. I mean, I'm one of your acolytes now.
Let me give you an example. Missouri. I was in Missouri.
They all run together, don't they, at this point?
They do, yeah. but my host was talking about her father, where he was not in the choir at all. And he had this beautiful property. Most of it was lawn. It was immaculate. And he wouldn't allow her to plant anything on that property for years and years and years. Well, then she got into Monarch Watch. She got into the movement to save the monarch, and she was planting milkweeds at home. And actually, she was taking her kids over for him to watch so she could do monarch things. And he said, what are you doing? I'm going to save the monarch. Well, what do you mean? Well, I've got to plant milkweeds, explaining the issue. And about 5 days later, he calls her up and he says, well, maybe we should put some milkweeds at my house. She said, okay. So she went over, and they found a place along the back fence. They made a nice milkweed bed. And then he started to watch it. And then the monarchs came. They laid eggs. And he'd call her up. They just laid an egg. I found a larva. There's another monarch. You better come over right away. We better put in more milkweeds. And all, you know, simply by recognizing what these plants are doing, he changed overnight. So now he says, I've got space in my yard. I can actually put plants. So that's the value of the monarch. It gets people tuned into what all the plants in their yard could be doing.
Unfortunately, there are not enough species like the monarch because it extends to spiders. It extends to...
But this is why I talk about birds, because we do have a lot of people interested in birds, and those birds are eating the insects and they're eating the spiders. Spiders are the second most important component of bird food webs. And you get that 70 million bird lovers out there recognizing that every plant they put in their yard is a bird feeder or has the potential of being a bird feeder. Then they get into it too. So immediately the ranks swell by 70 million. That's good. That's good. And then they talk to people. All of a sudden it's a change in culture.
We have decided that plants are beautiful. They are. So they become our decorations. We're going to decorate our landscapes with beautiful plants. So why not go all over the world and look for the most beautiful plants, bring them back, and sell them? So when we go to the nursery, that's what we're looking for. Is it beautiful? Can it be a screen, an anchor, or a focal point? But it's all about aesthetics. We are not considering the ecological roles those plants need to play at home to create those services we just talked about. But we could. We could have beautiful plants that are also creating food webs. If we don't have food webs at home, we don't have any other life form. They could be sequestering carbon. They could be protecting pollinators, doing an awful lot of what we talk about. But we have to consider function when we choose those plants in order for that to happen. So how do we do that? What does a biodiversity-friendly neighborhood look like? This is the most important thing we need to talk about. We had a little group meeting up here beforehand. How do we make corridors, functional biological corridors, right where we live, work, and play? If we do that, we connect the isolated habitat fragments that are out there with each other. And if they're connected, they are not isolated anymore. And if they're not isolated anymore, the populations within them are not tiny anymore. So when they fluctuate, they won't disappear anymore. That is the single most important thing we need to do to stop the steady drain of species from our local ecosystems.
Okay, living landscape, you know, Bringing Nature Home talked about basically why we need to rethink our landscapes, not so much on how to do that. But Rick Dark, who's a noted landscape designer, consultant, he's come from the horticultural botanical side.
And he's your co-author on this.
He's the co-author of Living Landscapes. And he approached me and he said, let's write a book together. I would cover the ecological aspects. He would cover the horticulture aspects to demonstrate that the two sides can come together and come up with a compromise. And it was funny because Rick has come from, he worked at Longwood Gardens for 20 years. He's very much the horticultural side of things. And the compromise was going to be, well, look, we're going to make productive, functional landscapes that are dominated by native plants, but occasionally you can't find a native solution to a particular landscape challenge, so here are plants that would work. And I agreed to do that. And the end product, yeah, there are some of those plants in there, but it's vastly native. Rick has come to see the light, you know.
So you convinced him as well.
The argument has convinced him. Well, now there's still, you know, he'll still say, "There, look, I want a low-growing shrub along my walk here. Viburnum dentatum gets 12 feet tall. It's too big. What am I going to use?" And in particular areas of the country, there really are not native solutions to every single landscape challenge. Does that mean your landscape can't be productive? No, it doesn't. So what we talk about are methods for getting more plants into your landscape, and that means making them three-dimensional landscapes instead of just two-dimensional. Right now, if we have trees, we have a canopy tree with nothing underneath it till you hit the ground. So there's a tremendous amount of open space. That's three or four niches lost to air.
Well, and I think it goes back to a general lack of understanding about shade plants, especially native shade plants. When we think natives, we think prairie. We think of big, coneflowers and that sort of thing. Although coneflower will take a fair amount of shade, it really will.
Sure.
It is such an honor to finally meet you, and a pleasure. And I appreciate you taking the time. I know that you're being rushed through all this stuff, but the fact that you talked to me this long is, I'm very grateful for.
Well, I'm grateful for the opportunity, as always.
You can find more information about the Mike Novak Show at mikenovak.net. That's MikeNowak.net for links, photos, and commentary.
You've talked about the idea of